Welcome to the Retail Focus Podcast, a weekly collection of news, interviews, and information from the world of retail.
Welcome to this edition of the Retail Focus Podcast. I'm Trent Kling for Leighton Working Behind the Scenes. Coming up on this week's episode, we've got a bit of a blast from the past as we get nostalgic and also look at the toll closing a retail store takes on store management. In news, we've got a couple of grocery stories, including big news from Western, or mostly Western U.S. grocery chain Grocery Outlet. And we'll look ahead at the possibility of the United States Postal Service charging even more this year for seasonal shipping come October. A quick reminder that you can like us or rate us however you access us. Those ratings certainly help others to check out the podcast and hear it for perhaps the first time. Heard from a couple of first-time listeners this past week on social media. Speaking of which, you can follow us there at Retail Podcast. I believe Leighton just uploaded some pictures of regional off-price retailer Walls in Oklahoma. It's quite a store experience there if you check those out on Instagram. Also, big thanks to our sponsor this week and our partner, Quantum Metric. We'll talk about them a little later on as well. So let's get to news, as once again we talked about Grocery Outlet. Big news by way of Grocery Outlet this week, who revealed during their second quarter earnings a few different things. They brought aboard a new investor relations officer, as well as making an announcement regarding entrance into New Jersey. But the big story is them finally going digital after earnings call of management saying, hey, we don't know that it'll work with our particular model. Grocery Outlet seems to be finally accepting the way of e-commerce as it pertains to grocery. Now, for those who aren't aware, Grocery Outlet is a regional chain mostly situated on the West Coast, but their aspirations do seem to be better than that. I know we have a lot of listeners in the Southern California area. Those listeners will be well acquainted with Grocery Outlet, but the New York area listeners might become better acquainted with Grocery Outlet as they are planning an opening in New Jersey. That would make their seventh state, currently 402 stores in six states. They ended the previous quarter with 400, the second quarter, that is. They opened 11 new stores, by the way, in the second quarter. They are mostly on the West Coast, but do have several stores in Pennsylvania. Currently, those Pennsylvania stores have been solid in terms of sales, thus the planned opening in New Jersey, and they plan even more in the Mid-Atlantic region as time goes by. However, their semi-off-price model, as we talked about, hasn't really lended itself to e-commerce up to this point, at least according to management. Yet, you could see this change coming given their tie-ins to various really strong CPGs and their increasing commitment to carrying regular products. So they have part of a treasure hunt model, an off-price model, part of a kind of regular everyday product model, including produce and meat. So to make a comparison, they're almost kind of in that Big Lots style model range, except I would say that the split is probably 60-40 everyday goods to off-price goods, whereas Big Lots now is a lot closer to maybe 80-20. So a lot of staples in their stores, but also they dabble in that off-price bargain hunt aspect of things. There is another fly in the ointment here as far as e-commerce is concerned. Longtime listeners may remember our discussion of their unique ownership model, wherein the majority of their stores are run by independent operators. So that also makes a corporate e-com push a little bit more difficult, at least logistically, although certainly not insurmountable as we see from franchise setups in the fast food and QSR space. Now, quick numbers from their earnings call this week. I don't want to spend a lot of time on this, but it is important because we have been talking a lot lately about grocery comps. Comps were down for Grocery Outlet 10% even after an increase in last year's second quarter of 16.7%. On a two-year stack, this puts them in an increase of 6.7%, which is right around the middle, maybe the lower end of the middle of most grocery operators that we've heard from so far for this time period. Overall net sales were down 3.5%, mostly as a function of those comp decreases, But those were countered somewhat, of course, by the new store openings, both in the past quarter and the past year. In aggregate, though, results were better than the company expected, particularly on the comp front. By the way, in terms of the store openings, they still expect to open about 35 to 37 net new stores during the fiscal year. And they did give quarter-to-date comps as well for the third quarter. Those are down so far around 6%, which is right in the range of their mid-single-digit drop expectations. But as I said, the big story from this earnings call is their suggested foray into e-commerce. And the story originally brought to our attention via an article from Russell Redman of Supermarket News. Currently, Grocery Outlet's website, if you go there now, offers a look at their weekly ad and then a social media area, a lot of Instagram pictures, you have a store locator, gift card offers, etc. But no form of e-commerce whatsoever available on the website. And so offering any kind of online shopping would be a big step. And to be clear, this seems like it's still a little ways off from implementation. And they're not looking internally to implement, of course. They're looking at third-party partners so that maybe they can get up and running a little bit more quickly. And CEO Eric Lindberg said on their call that they are beginning dialogues with multiple third-party providers to potentially pilot one or more programs. And that was one of the interesting things. They're not set with just one provider. I think they want to cast a pretty wide net to see what works and what doesn't work with their ownership model, with the off-price model, and so forth. Looking at getting started potentially as soon as the next few months, although reading between the lines, probably looking at the end of the year, end of the calendar year, that is, for these things to be launched. Now, the biggest thing for leadership regarding e-commerce and the implementation thereof appears to be attempting to keep their treasure hunt model valid in an e-commerce setting. They talked a lot about the emotion of the customer when they go to a grocery outlet store, when they find those bargains. And Lindberg talked a lot on the call about how any potential partnership they would have to be an extension of this model in terms of really fueling the positive emotions of the consumer rather than just a way to offer their, again, typical CPG-driven staples through an online platform. So all of this leads, of course, to a natural question. What type of digital services might we be looking at here for Grocery Outlet? Are we looking at buy online, pickup in store? Are we looking at delivery? Are we looking at other options for them? Well, president of the company, RJ Sheedy, said that multiple options will probably be trialed in their pilots, including buy online, pickup in store, and delivery. And Sheedy mentioned that they're looking to evaluate several key things in the implementation of the pilots. But again, that aspect coming up first and foremost is how a particular platform and service might work with that independent ownership model and their treasure hunt positioning. Those two things seem to be the most important things to the company, at least as it pertains to the call, as it pertains to the analyst Q&A regarding e-commerce and a foray into it. Other factors for them that they mentioned included operational and technical considerations, of course, as it would for any retailer, as well as overall market opportunity. What it sounds like is they'd like a third-party supplier, of course, with a large cache of existing customers so that maybe they can tap into new customers rather than just, say, pushing their existing customers to the e-commerce platform. And you know, we talked about it in the open. The company was so hesitant for so long to head towards e-commerce and grocery. Part of that understandable for all the reasons we've mentioned. They kept harping on the treasure hunt aspect. And this is going to provide challenges in two ways, a couple of which at least talked about on the call by management. One is they want to ensure that, again, that emotion, that atmosphere of the bargain hunt fully translates into online shopping, not only as far as stimulation of the shoppers is concerned, but also building cart size. When customers go to a grocery outlet store, by the way, Leighton and I both big fans of the store and the chain, although I don't live in a grocery outlet market, I do my best to visit one whenever I am in a market with a grocery outlet. But when you go to one of the stores, you might be there to pick up a few staples. And if you see a bargain, if you see one of those closeouts, you're tempted to add that to your cart, which of course adds to their top line revenue. Big question for them is, How do they get those impulse buys surrounding the bargains that they have, surrounding the selling of that surplus merchandise to customers in a digital fashion? Now, another issue is for Grocery Outlet. It's not uncommon for people actually visiting the stores to load up on certain bargains when they see them. For example, I was at a grocery outlet in rural Northern California earlier this year, and I saw with my own two eyes, there was a closeout on a particular style of chip that this customer really liked, and they filled their shopping cart with them. They had probably 15 to 20 bags of these chips, cleaned the shelves completely. Now, what happens when someone purchases this product online? It's out of stock by the time the pickers make it around. It's obviously a worry, as we saw during panic buying of the pandemic, for regular grocers, regular stores like Kroger and Albertsons and Walmart, of course. But even more so when you have this bargain hunt aspect and you might have people really, really trying to take advantage of those in store. So how do you manage that from a technical side? And also, how do you manage customer expectations? We know from the pandemic that products that appear in stock to online customers that are ordered by online customers, but that are unable to be fulfilled, that provides a negative customer experience and is one reason those who have tried e-com grocery that don't necessarily like it and haven't necessarily adhered to it, it's something that they cite as something that they don't appreciate about e-com grocery. And remember, we talked to some numbers with an interview guest several months ago about the fact that not everyone that trialed e-com grocery is going back to e-com grocery as the pandemic was easing. Now, of course, we have the Delta variant to worry about, so you might see people going back to e-com grocery out of necessity. But still, this is a main reason why people don't necessarily like that particular type of platform, and something that Grocery Outlet really has to answer to, and more importantly, those third-party partners really have to answer to. Now, one final initiative they've put into place that's worth discussing as far as Grocery Outlet is concerned, their variable weight produce offers. Now, what I mean by this is Grocery Outlet has always been big on a lot of pre-prepared packages of produce, not unlike if you go to a Kroger or an Albertsons or Safeway or what have you, the 3-pound bags of apples one might see in a traditional grocer. We know these packages have become more popular as grab-and-go options for customers since last March, since the onset of the pandemic across all retailers, and that's what overall holistic produce sales data tells us. However, Grocery Outlet's working to introduce variable sizing as a way to provide options to customers who may not be looking for larger quantities. During this last quarter, they finally rolled that out to all of their stores. As a whole, by the way, their natural, organic, specialty, and healthy category, the category they call NOSH for short, was a big sales driver, as was produce and fresh meat. So what we're seeing there, very consistent with the rest of the grocery industry currently. Well, I mentioned in the open, as we bring to a close the first news segment, that we're looking to the past here a little bit this week, and I want to explain things just a little bit. We had the opportunity back in 2017 to interview Kylie Leonetti and Christian Jensen of Kylie and Christian Creative regarding their documentary, The Closing of Alco Store 208. Now, if you're from the Midwest, if you're from the Great Plains, you're probably familiar with the Alco store chain. Feeling a little bit nostalgic this summer, as this summer would have marked the 120th anniversary of Duckwall Alco Stores Incorporated, once known as just Duckwall Stores, then Duckwall Alco Stores, and then just Alco Stores by the time they declared bankruptcy. Store chain hasn't been around now for several years, but again, this would have been their 120th anniversary. And I think this is a good exercise to kind of look back. You know, we talk from time to time about store closings on the podcast. You see it a lot in media, whether it's Kmart and Sears stores closing or other full-line stores that happen to be closing. But the interesting thing about this documentary, which is, by the way, really well produced, it's available on Vimeo if you just search The Closing of Alco Store 208, or if you go to their website, kylieandchristian.com. The interesting thing about this documentary is it really covers the way in which a closing of a store impacts the people that work there, specifically management who have poured their heart and soul into it. You know, we talk to so many people who are involved in the retail industry on a weekly basis, and it is an industry that grabs you, that brings you in. And so what happens when that very same industry that brings you in kind of pushes you away via a closing? Well, we're going to flash back to that interview back in 2017. So some of the aspects of the interview might be a little bit past tense, if you will, but I still think it's instructive as far as looking into this mindset, and it provides at least me personally a way to kind of feed my nostalgia about Alco Stores, if you will. Yeah, we talked about digital grocery, especially in the first segment, and I want to talk specifically to the digital leaders at companies out there. I know you are listening. How would it feel to not only know what your customer is experiencing, but how many others in aggregate are experiencing this too? Kind of that quiet majority effect. And I think it's time that we put this quiet majority at the center of decisions, put customers at the center of decisions, and get ahead with real-time insights way before a code freeze happens. Now, again, it's warm outside. It's very warm in certain parts of the country. But for retailers, the holiday season and thinking about the holiday season has already begun. Of course, orders have been placed. You're hoping shipments get here on time regarding that merchandise. But what about e-commerce? 2021 holiday e-commerce sales are expected to exceed 2020 benchmarks, and you should be prepared to capture every customer revenue opportunity. With Quantum Metric, our show partner, you can be. Their unique approach to the digital customer experience helps today's top retailers and e-commerce brands quickly identify and prioritize the big and small revenue opportunities that keep customers engaged and coming back. Again, we're discussing really continuous product design here. Quantum Metric helps retailers we talk about all the time on the show. I could list them all off, but I'll give you two examples. Bass Pro Shops and Crate and Barrel among their customers. Why shouldn't your business be a customer of Quantum Metric as well? You should stay off the naughty list this holiday season by reducing customer friction, increasing conversions, and personalizing the shopping experience. If you want a sneak peek, you can visit them at quantummetric.com/podoffer and see if you qualify to receive their 12 Days of Insights offer with code RETAILFOCUS. That's all one word, RETAILFOCUS. This offer gives you 12-day access to their platform coupled with a bespoke insight report that will help you identify where customers are struggling or engaging in your digital product pretty much immediately. Now, restrictions do apply, and you can check out that website once again, quantummetric.com/podoffer. The link is in the show notes. Check them out. Once again, quantummetric.com/podoffer. Use the code RETAILFOCUS to see if you're eligible to receive their 12 Days of Insights offer. As longtime listeners of the Retail Focus podcast know, from time to time, we get into businesses that are struggling or have gone bankrupt. And actually, last year, we talked to a couple of mayors who had their own Alco stores in their small towns closed down. And we were fortunate enough, about a month ago, we found a documentary called The Closing of Alco Store 208. It really is fascinating. You can go out on Vimeo, search for it, The Closing of Alco Store 208. It's well done, and we're very fortunate to have the producers and the director of that documentary with us today to talk a little bit about formation of this documentary and about, of course, the closing of this Alco store a couple of years ago. Kylie Leonetti and Christian Jensen, thank you so much for joining the Retail Focus podcast today.
Thank you for having us and for getting my name right.
Yeah. It was a good guess, I must admit, but we'll start out here, you know, obviously with Thomas Jensen, the store manager of this particular Alco store. Where did the idea for kind of documenting the last 10 days of this Alco store's existence come about? How was this hatched after you first found out about the store closing? And then how did you find out about the store closing?
It's kind of funny because I didn't make this very apparent in the documentary intentionally, but Thomas is my father. Actually, I make a cameo in the movie as one of the little children in the montage of photos of the grand opening. So I'd always, as an aspiring filmmaker, been interested in the world of retail just because I heard about it most nights over the dinner table. And so I toyed with different ideas and was even writing a screenplay about a retail manager. And at some point, I just found out his store was closing and, you know, was kind of paying attention to that process. And then he'd asked me at one point if I could come and just shoot some video of his store, mainly just, you know, for his own archival look back. And I started to think that there might be a story there. There might be something kind of interesting because it's a point of view, I think, that's not often seen. Is, you know, we hear about these things happening, and usually it's from the corporate level and not so much the ground level.
Building off of that a little bit, one of the interesting things about store closures, as you mentioned, so much of it is from the corporate level. It's about dollars and cents. We don't really talk about the lives of the store managers or the employees that are impacted. So as filmmakers, what did you guys find most interesting in just covering the human interest aspect of the store closure?
You know, as producer, I was on set not as much as Christian, but every time I was in the store, even in the last hours of it, it was very much business as usual. That was very interesting to me, that it wasn't as I expected it to be. We wouldn't think maybe it would be mayhem, or I think Christian maybe thought your dad would break down more or something like that. But we were very surprised / impressed at how business as usual everything was at Alco until the very last minute. Well, would you agree?
Yeah. And I think, too, by kind of focusing on him and less the company and really trying to figure out why, you know, I feel like you get that elsewhere. And I really wanted to focus on him and how does one deal with something like this? You know, he'd been there for that particular store for 26 and a half years and that company for close to probably over 30, you know, and how do you kind of deal with that? And not even so much like a looking back on it, but in the moment, how are you dealing with that? It was interesting because, yeah, like Kylie said, it wasn't, the way he was wasn't necessarily what I was expecting. I was expecting it to be a little more somber and maybe even him a little less willing to open up to the camera. But then I remembered who my dad was, and that's who he is, though. He's like, he lives for a good laugh. And I think it was obviously, too, a way for him to, I think, cope with it, you know, keeping that routine up. And then, oddly, I think his son being there, if it had been someone else with a camera, I don't know if I would have been able to get the honesty and the intimacy that I was able to get.
You know, Kylie mentioned something pretty interesting in that oftentimes when we think about store closures, we think about liquidation sales and we think about chaos and we think of, you know, messy shelves and all of that. As you can see in the documentary, there's not a whole lot of that. The store is clean and well-kept up until its final hour, even past its closing time. And obviously there's a sense of ownership there that you get the sense of through the interviews with Thomas Jensen. But did that seem to carry over when you guys were on set with some of the other employees? Were some of the other employees taking ownership with the company until that very last day?
Oh, definitely. Yeah. People who were with him at the end, I think there was at least one woman who had been there since day one. And there had been a few others who had been there for a few years, you know, and they could have left, and a lot of people did, and a lot of managers in the company left when it all kind of started. But yeah, I feel like the people who were there were very loyal to my dad and to the store, and I think that because of that attention to detail and taking pride, I think because Tom still took pride in that, that rubbed off on the employees. You know, he kind of continued to inspire them in however he had been.
He ran an immaculate ship. It was beautiful. So I think that was just the store motto. It was kind of, you know, live up to Tom's expectations. They did.
Oh, yeah. He was always waxing the floors. And I remember growing up a lot, like, oh, Dad has to go in early to go wax the floors. You know, he was always, that was, the appearance of his store was very important. He's very detail-oriented.
I want to talk a little bit about the videography now in the documentary. You guys are based in Minnesota, so you have a little bit of a drive out there to South Dakota where this Alco store is. How much in terms of your approach to the documentary, you know, did the crew kind of talk about this on the way out there, or did it take shape more once you got into the Alco? And what was your approach with shooting, you know, basically an empty store?
First of all, I'll talk about the approach to the empty store. I did have, you know, when you shoot a documentary, you don't know exactly what's going to happen. So it's hard to imagine shots that aren't going to happen. But I did know that I was going to be going into an empty store. And as a filmmaker, a cinematographer, as a business owner. We've done a number of videos for small businesses, and there's a kind of style out there of, you know, the DSLR with a slider, and you make maybe the coffee shop look cool, you know, with some cinematic camera movements. And I thought it'd be interesting to kind of do what I would normally do, but of the empty stores, and not necessarily trying to make them sad, but just kind of show them as they are. And maybe there's a little bit of irony in that it's a cool jib shot of store closing signs rather than, you know, a store full of inventory. So that was kind of how I guess we approached the empty shelves. And I guess without getting too artsy with it, they are kind of a metaphor, I guess. You walk through there and you think, oh, this is a metaphor. For what exactly? I don't know. I guess that comes out when you start combining image with sound, whether it be music or with Tom's voice and what he might be saying. They kind of begin to play off of each other in interesting ways. You know, you kind of just gather as much as you can while you're there, because documentary is more so than I think scripted work is really built in the edit and trying to find kind of connections between what someone said and what you might have shot. The crew was pretty small. It was primarily me and a couple high school students from Milbank. When we were coming, my dad had brought up a high school student he knew of named Tanner Hackwith, who was interested in video, and he had some gear, and so I reached out to him and asked if he would be interested in coming and helping out.
He was invaluable.
And he was invaluable. You know, I sent him out in the store sometimes when I was interviewing Tom to get the footage around the store, and he operated the camera for me sometimes, you know, like when we were walking around the store sometimes, so that I could kind of focus mm-hmm. on interviewing. And there was another kid there, J.P. Lindquist, and he ran sound for us when he was there. They were my crew, and I wasn't there the full 10 days. I think 4 total days of shooting, some full, some half.
That provides a lot of insight into the thought process there. I want to play a couple of clips from the documentary, and we'll start with this particular clip as Thomas Jensen is making the final announcement as far as the store closure is concerned. Let's take a listen here.
Attention, Uncle Shoppers. After 26 and a half years being here in Milbank, South Dakota, we will be closing. I just want to say thank you for just being loyal customers to us, and thank you for shopping at Elko. Thank you.
A lot of power in that announcement, and one of the reasons is because you kind of make reference, several references actually, to multiple announcements that the employees are making over the PA system, over the loudspeaker announcing the closing. And it seems like every time that announcement is made, it gives Thomas reason for pause. How much of an emotional roller coaster was this week for him? You mentioned he managed to keep his emotions in check somewhat.
For Tom, you know, I think because he was in charge of it, he still had to, you know, maintain, I think, you know, kind of put on that face of the leader. I didn't see, you know, there wasn't a moment where I overheard him in the other room, you know, sobbing or anything like that. But there's one moment when he does, we're in the store, we're talking about something, and he does kind of break down. But that was really the only time. And I think there's one point in the office where he talks about running the store as if it was his own and why he didn't leave. Those were really, other than that, he was real strong about it.
Well, and I think he, as he mentions in the film a couple of times, his faith is something that he's always really kept close to his heart, so it keeps him going. And I think he's the kind of person, just in the time I spent with him shooting and in life, he's the kind of person who really believes if something's happening to him, it's for a reason. And so I think he's good at seeing the bigger picture in something, even a store closing that he's managed for, you know, almost 27 years. He's still able to see that there's something bigger at work and it's not the end of the world. So we didn't know that about him necessarily before we went in. I think I learned that while we were shooting with him. I've interviewed a lot of people, and I can get people to crack by asking them certain questions, and I think you can have that experience too. And he doesn't crack. I mean, he didn't crack up while we were filming. So unless he has some dark secret cry closet somewhere that we don't know about.
Yes, but we didn't see it. Yeah. I think honestly, you know, his employees, they were visibly more.
Yes, his employees were wrecked.
You know, that was something. And because I didn't get to spend a lot of time with them, that's maybe one thing that would have, if I could have gotten more of something, I would have wanted to get just a little bit more interaction with them, but they were working and there weren't that many of them still around. But they tended to be the ones, if there were going to be some tears shed, they were the ones.
Now, I know you guys probably didn't spend a ton of time interacting with customers, but we've talked about Tom and his employees' reaction to it. What was the general sense that you got from the customers there in Milbank about the closing of this Alco store?
I think the community was worried that there wouldn't be another store like it. I think that was the biggest thing I heard in the aisles. You know, as we're walking through and Christian's shooting and I'm shopping the deals, it was clear that everyone was wondering what was going to happen next and if there was going to be another space for a store in that community, if there was going to be a replacement for Alco.
And I think they were really confused too, yeah, because the store was not unsuccessful. It still had really good sales numbers and there were still a lot of people, you know, like you mentioned, you know, not many of the stores in the company were losing money and his store definitely wasn't. So, you know, I think the community was kind of
puzzled.
There it was, you know, it came as kind of a shock. They didn't really know why. And I think that, and then, yeah, like she said, just they were kind of worried, like, what are we going to do now? Because it's also, it feeds the smaller community, because Milbank is a really small community compared to Minneapolis, but it's, for where it is, it's a bigger community in the area. And so it, a lot of people from those smaller towns come in to shop at Elko and the other, you know, grocery stores that they have and stuff. So that was another concern, was not just the people of Milbank, but the people outside of Milbank too.
If it makes you feel any better, I know a lot of people in the retail community were kind of confused by the entire bankruptcy and liquidation proceedings as well. Did the people of Milbank get another store? Has that location been occupied?
Yeah, it currently has a Shopko.
Yeah, Tom was actually, in his departure from Alco and in time in between, he was very influential in getting a Shopko put into the building. So I think there were even some things he had to overcome, like spatial constraints and size of the floor plan, and he had to really convince Shopko to get in the space. So, but Shopko's there now.
Yeah, they were kind of moving in on a lot of the Alco stores, those buildings that they were closing. And they didn't originally want to move into that store because it was a little smaller. But, yeah, they were able to work that out and a few other things. But, yeah. Yep.
Played a big part in that.
I think one of the strongest quotes in this from Tom Jensen, later on in the documentary, he says that retail is weird. It sucks you in. He also says that he can't wait to run another store. Is he still involved in retail in some way? What's Tom up to now?
Well, he has just become certified to sell insurance in South Dakota. So he's going to be selling insurance with Aflac. And he spent some time, he was selling cars in Milbank at a local dealership in kind of the in-between time. So I guess he has moved on from Shopko.
There's a brief period in time that it was maybe going to be his future to work at Shopko, but it was not a natural fit for him. So
It didn't pan out. Yeah.
But he, I think one thing we learned in making the documentary and getting to know Tom a lot better in the process is how much of his identity he did wrap up in the store and how it maybe didn't bring him as much happiness as he really thought it did. It took up a lot of his time. I mean, managing a retail store, as you've heard, I'm sure, it's hard. It's not work for a man nearing retirement if he doesn't have it in him as much anymore. And so I think a lot of his job was not his favorite part of the job anymore either. So it's given him the opportunity to discover what he really does like to do and how he likes to spend his time. And I think working with Aflac is going to help him do that a lot more.
Well, yeah, it's a very, he started in retail when he was still in high school. And so from that point on until that store closed, he kind of knew what he was going to do. And yeah, he got the opportunity to think about what his life might look like another way. And that's not easy to do, particularly when it's kind of like forced on you and there's some transition, but he's making that transition.
He's doing great.
Yeah, he's doing great.
I want to play one more clip from the documentary, and this is towards the end of the documentary. It starts off with a couple of fantastic questions. The question you asked just prior to this is, if you could ask Alco any question, what would it be? And then we have this question here.
If you could say anything to Alco, what would it be?
Thank you. Not thank him for closing the store. You know, that would be dope. Yeah, hit the career stopping. You know, that happens all the time in this world. You know what the hardest thing was so far? last night, the last night of sales, was punching in my security numbers. That was really difficult. I don't know why. It was like, I can't do it, you know? Because that was hard.
You get him basically saying something very similar to what you guys were saying, and that his identity was so wrapped up in Alco, very tough to move on, tough to punch in those security numbers on the last day in the store. And as you've mentioned, he has moved on, he has gone forward, but how does he still regard Alco, and then did he ever get answers to his questions?
The answers to his questions, he never got.
Does he still stay in touch with some of the other managers, though?
He does still stay in touch with some of the other managers.
Any of them get an answer to that question?
I don't think any of them did. I don't think any of them ever really asked. I think it was one of those cases where you have the question, but you also maybe know you're not going to get the answer. Because they had been told, you know, this, that, and the other thing, but I don't think that was it really. None of those could give a satisfying explanation to it. So, yeah, he hasn't gotten those answers. I think he does look back on the work and the people he worked with and the things he was able to do.
Because of that.
Because he was the manager of Elko, he was able to do things in the community and be involved in that way. He saw a lot of people come through as employees. He had there was one woman I know who worked with him in the very beginning. You know, she was an associate, and now she owns one of the restaurants in town, you know. So he also, you know, maybe played a role in people's lives in the community, and I think he feels really good about that. I think there's probably still some bad blood towards Elko. I know that there's also some outstanding workman's comp BS that they're dealing with too, you know, so there's some lingering, I think, frustrations there. But I think that he doesn't regret it.
I think he maybe would have wanted it to be on his terms more, but at the same time, I think that he can't help but be thankful to them for giving him such stability for all those years too. I think, you know, he stayed through until your sister was done with school, until all of that. So I think it's good. He remembers what it was for him in his life and for his family, and it afforded them the stability to do a lot of things.
You could say he's probably like an eternal optimist in that way.
He really is an eternal optimist. I mean, I don't think you could get him to say bad things about Alco.
Kylie Leonetti and Christian Jensen, the producers and director for the documentary Closing of Alco Store 208. Thanks so much for joining us today on the podcast.
Thank you.
Thank you for having me.
As always, we may have a position in or against companies we discuss on the podcast. Do not invest in stocks solely on the input of the podcast hosts.
Once again, Kylie Leonetti and Christian Jensen of Kylie and Christian Creative. Now, they do a lot of cool video, even today, for retailers. Not all of it, of course, is documentaries covering retailers that are closing, but awesome work that they do. You can check it out, kylieandchristian.com. You can also check out their Vimeo page, where the Closing of Alco Store 208 is available to view for free. Now, in the intervening time since that interview, of course, Shopko, which took over that space with the Hometown Store, went bankrupt there, and so they pulled out of Milbank, South Dakota as well. The location is now split between a Dollar General and a few other stores. Ironically, it's next door to a relatively new Family Dollar. So it's kind of indicative of where retail has gone. Certainly a Dollar General right next to a Family Dollar, where there had been a 25,000 square foot Alco store and then a Shopko Hometown Store as well. So it kind of hurts some small communities in a sense. Dollar General and Family Dollar, of course, doing very well sales-wise, but the likes of Alco, Shopko Hometown, they sold things that you couldn't really get at the dollar stores, you know, things like fishing poles, for example, or furniture. So it is a different retail landscape in those communities when those general merchandisers close down, and it really is a bygone era, and who knows, we might be revisiting this interview again in 2026 as we look back at the 125th anniversary, or what would have been the 125th anniversary of Duckwall Alco Stores Incorporated. Well, one more grocery news story to tackle, and really it's kind of a combination news story and looking ahead. We'll keep it short here. Comes by way of Giant Eagle. Now, the grocer, based, of course, in Pittsburgh, locations throughout the upper and eastern Midwest, announced this week that they will now accept PayPal and Venmo payments. This happens to make them the first major grocer or convenience chain to do so. We've talked on the show with various interview guests from FIS and Deloitte as examples about the increase in willingness to use mobile wallets throughout the U.S. and throughout all age groups. The offer to use PayPal and Venmo here for Giant Eagle seems like a valid extension of this, of course, especially with the proliferation of customers using those two platforms, particularly Venmo has picked up in popularity. Now, the payments, how those will work on the front end, it'll work similarly to how one might currently pay an organization, business, what have you, via PayPal or Venmo. You simply open up the app and you scan the QR code. So this gives customers the optionality to pay via your platform balance. If you have balance in your PayPal or Venmo account, you can pay via a saved bank account or a saved debit or credit card. Platform, by the way, is being driven by the Blackhawk Network. Blackhawk, of course, is known also as a major provider of gift card kiosks to retailers. We've talked about that on the show as well in the past. Now, given the increased use of digital wallets, it would make sense that this is a potential option that customers might enjoy. And as we've discussed in the past, the main question for retailers when introducing payment methods is security and effective implementation. Because you might say, well, why doesn't every retailer do this? Why doesn't every retailer make PayPal and Venmo an option to pay with? Well, part of the reason they don't offer every payment platform imaginable is that you do have to implement it effectively, but also the security and the safety of this. And when you're looking at risk management from a retail store's perspective, sometimes it might not make sense. We should also note that despite the large numerical increases in digital wallet usage, when we talk about it going up, you know, maybe 50 to 60% over the past year, in terms of the piece of the pie, as far as payment methods are concerned, it's still a relatively small amount of the payment method share. So I don't expect this will have a massive top-line impact for Giant Eagle. It's hard to imagine someone going to Giant Eagle simply because they allow you to pay with your Venmo or PayPal balance, but certainly something that's not going to hurt either. It's only going to serve to provide customers with an additional option there at the front end. And unlike with some things in retail, data suggests that payment options are not an area where customers suffer from that paradox of choice. Customers want as many options as possible on the front end when it comes to paying. They would rather have too many options available to them than too few, which again isn't like everything in retail. So certainly you tip your cap to Giant Eagle for getting this done and Blackhawk Network for implementing it. Of course, be keeping an eye on just how many overall retailers jump on this bandwagon as well. Now, our true looking ahead story for this week is regarding the United States Postal Service, as we get word this week via the Wall Street Journal that they may increase seasonal charges even more this holiday season. Ultimately, the question, the go-forward question, if you will, is how will this impact e-com pure plays and any retailer that doesn't have an internal fulfillment mechanism, like, for example, an Amazon or, like in some markets, a Walmart, especially since we know now that customers have come to expect free shipping breakpoints, whether that's at $39 of online spend or $59 or $69 or whatever that happens to be. If customers reach those breakpoints that they've come to expect, this is only going to further pass costs to companies' bottom lines and put additional cost pressure on e-commerce, which is already generally less profitable for most retailers than brick and mortar, of course, for those that have both options that are out there. Now, a couple of things of note, really, regarding this particular story. According to the Wall Street Journal, again, these could range from 25 cents for certain packages to $5 for heavier items that are going longer distances. These will be in place from October 3rd to December 26th and will apply to both commercial and retail customers. So that means, you know, if you're personally going to the post office and shipping something, you'll see that happen as well as you would a business like, oh, I don't know, Sierra, for example, shipping out a pair of trail running shoes, as I just had done this past week. So ultimately, you're looking at retailers once again, bottom lines being squeezed. And we know from past experience, it's not only going to be the United States Postal Service here, it's going to be UPS and FedEx also implementing something similar. So again, looking ahead, how will this impact people's bottom lines with the Delta variant? Will we see an even bigger increase in e-commerce shopping than we were expecting over the holiday season? How do retailers cope with all of these e-com pressures that we are now seeing? So lots of questions as you head into the holiday season. And you have to wonder if, again, a lot of those retailers out there that have those fulfillment contracts either with UPS or FedEx, if they might benefit versus the smaller retailers that have been using the United States Postal Service that might not be large enough to have those larger scale deals with UPS and FedEx. You wonder if this kind of squeezes out those smaller e-com businesses or the mom and pops that are shipping things during the holiday season. So lots of questions yet to be answered. And it's still just August. There's a lot of uncertainty surrounding this year's holiday season, including, of course, the looming aspect of the Delta variant and perhaps a flow back to e-commerce shopping for those who might have abandoned it in lieu of brick-and-mortar shopping since the pandemic eased earlier this year, at least in terms of those numbers. Well, that'll do it for our podcast this week. A big thanks to Leighton behind the scenes, putting everything together for us. And also a big thanks to our show partners, Quantum Metric. Again, you can check them out, quantummetric.com/podoffer. Use the code RETAILFOCUS. That link is in the show notes for this week. Now, coming up next week, we've got an interview with Stefan Reed, who's the Senior Vice President of Engagement Advisory and Strategy Practice Lead at Jackman. He's going to join us to discuss their partnerships with retailers such as Joann, Staples, and more, as well as their Human Insights study regarding purchase decision criteria for customers in retail stores. It's an interesting conversation. Coming weeks, we're going to be joined by Erica Blair of the Rural Grocery Initiative and Mary Rogers as well, who's the Director of Marketing Communications at Cuisinart, who will discuss their marketing strategy regarding not only e-commerce direct-to-consumer sales, but also marketing through various retailers as well. So a trio of really just powerhouse interviews coming up for you in the next 3 weeks. Until the next podcast hits about 7 days from now, I'm Trent saying so long.
This has been the Retail Focus Podcast. For more, visit our website at retailfocuspodcast.com and subscribe on iTunes or Stitcher. Follow us on Twitter at Retail Podcast.